What I was going to talk about, which I'll frame it differently now than I was going to frame it before, is how much we do things in character. That we have, you know, our character. We have, and we often do things in our character. So there was a story of back from the ancient times, from the Buddhist discourses, of a monk who was supposed to be enlightened, fully enlightened, arhat. And he was together with another group of monks, and they were wandering around the countryside, and they came to a river, and they were going to cross the river. They would ford it, and it was relatively shallow at one point. And in crossing the river, he went first, and he yanked up his skirt, his robes, which they wore, and pranced across. And then, in a very undignified, un-monk-like way. So the other monks were rather aghast at this behavior. So they went to the Buddha and said, you know, what's going on here? I mean, this guy is supposed to be fully enlightened, and he acted in such an undignified way. How can this be? And the Buddha said, never mind. In the former lifetime, for 500 former lifetimes, he was a monkey. And his monkey nature is still coming out. So I love that story because it's very, you know, how much of our personality, our character is, you know, is just part of who we are for whatever reason. And enlightenment, spiritual practice, is not going to get rid of it. But rather it becomes maybe clarified, maybe it becomes more highlighted as we become more free and more liberated rather than less so. So you might think that's bad news for some of your personality quirks. But maybe not. So when I first went to the San Francisco Zen Center many, many years ago, I just heard about it and I was just going to check it out. And I went there to be a guest student for 2 weeks. Ed Brown, who's come and spoke to us over the years a few times, a friend and someone I have tremendous respect for, was the kind of the head teacher at the city center when I went there. And I was 20, I believe, 20 years old. And I thought he was just the greatest, Ed Brown. And he was very kind of very, I don't know what to say, but a very upright, bright, very present person. And I was convinced after those 2 weeks that I was very taken by Zen practice. I wanted to follow Zen practice. And I was convinced that if I was going to follow through on Zen practice really well, I'd become just like Ed Brown. And I kind of carried that idea in my head for a couple of years because I went away and did other things. And then after 2 years, I came back to Zen Center to be a guest student again. And the first morning, I went to breakfast. And I think it was Philip Whalen, who was a priest at Zen Center, also a famous kind of poet from the beat poet times, was at breakfast. And he was eating his breakfast, his bowl of cereals, and reading the paper at the same time. And this, you know, I had been, you know, for all these years, I've been thinking about, you know, Zen, you do one thing at a time, one pointed. And I saw this guy, a Zen priest at Zen Center, you know, reading the paper while he was eating. And I said, oh, Ed Brown wouldn't do this. And then very quickly it occurred to me that in seeing, you know, Philip in contrast to Ed Brown was I realized luckily, oh, the point isn't to be like Ed Brown. The point is to be myself in some way. And so Philip was just being Philip, doing what Philip does. He's reading the paper while he was having his bowl of cereal. And so somehow that contrast, you know, of seeing those two, how different they were. It's just very different personalities if you know the two people. And then a few weeks ago here in this room, I told this already. I hope it wasn't Monday night. But anyway. Another, you know, is we had this meeting here, an all-day meeting of the kind of senior teachers of San Francisco Zen Center. They kind of wanted to get away from Zen Center for a day and kind of do a kind of retreat for among themselves and talk and be more personal and stuff. And so we had this question that everyone who was posed that they were supposed to kind of address and kind of, again, to kind of break the ice and learn about each other in a different way. And the question was, in your years of Zen practice, what has been the issue that you've most grappled with? What's been the most difficult issue in Zen practice, Zen teaching, that you really had to personally grapple with? And so there was some murmur of discontent about the question first. But eventually we got to talking about going around the circle and talking. And first person spoke about how felt that as soon as he heard the Zen teaching from Suzuki Roshi, almost 40 years ago now, that he really took to the Zen practice, and he never had any problems with it. It was, you know, he didn't have to grapple with anything. It was all very straightforward and just very easy to kind of relax into that space of emptiness or the big mind. And he's been, you know, he hasn't seen as many problems ever since. I mean, a little bit exaggerating. I can't, you know, characterize his what he said completely well, but that's the gist of it. And then another person spoke right away in the heels of him, I think partly in maybe in reaction to it, but said, oh, I'll go next because for me, Zen practice has been one continuous struggle. I struggle everywhere I go in my life. That's my life is all about struggle. And when I came to Zen Center, I struggled there too. Everything I did was a struggle. Okay, then the third person spoke, and she spoke kind of in response to the first two. She said, I'll go and do my sharing. And she said, oh, for me, Zen practice has always been a struggle, but I love to struggle. And I don't know if I can convey this, but I have to just take my word for it. But what I saw in these three people, and then the other people who spoke that day, was that these are people who have been practicing Zen, some of them for over 30 years, close to 40 years, and was how free they were in talking about who they were. And their foibles, their character, and they weren't trying to kind of fit into each other's mode, like, you know, this is what a Zen person is like. They were so different from each other. These, I think there were 13 people there at the room. They were so different from each other. And after 30, 40 years of practice, they were so willing. Just, this is who I am. They weren't, there's no apologies, no defense, no, they just put it out there. Now, I hope it takes more, faster than 30, 40 years to get to that kind of freedom. But I love that kind of freedom. It was really refreshing to be around these people who could just be themselves in this very free way. I've heard a number of therapists talk about the difference between having, in their particular situation, maybe it's very personal, maybe it's not, you can't generalize from their practice, but they said, and they've noticed a difference between meditators who come for them for therapy and non-meditators. And the difference is that it seems like the meditators are the Buddhists. Mostly it's Buddhists they were talking about that I remember, have the same problems as everybody else, but they're much more willing to talk about it. or they say they're a lot less defended, so they're much more free to come out with it. They don't take weeks and weeks of therapy to kind of build the trust and the safety and all that, so people are willing to talk about what's really going on. The people who have some practice background are much more willing. They know each other a little better, and they're much freer to talk about who they are. So some kind of self-acceptance, some kind of willingness to be who we are, I think is a very central aspect of a spiritual life, I hope. I hope that a spiritual life is not as taking some ideal, some assumption, or some other people's idea of what a human person is supposed to be like, and then trying to fit our personality and character into who that is. But rather, it's freeing ourselves from what's already here. Suzuki Roshi, who was a teacher at San Francisco Zen Center, in commenting about the forms of Zen Center, the Zen forms where you go into the Zendo and everybody has to stand the same way and walk the same way and sit the same way, and it's also structured. He said, because it's also structured, who you are as a person can stand out much more clearly. Because it gets highlighted. The little difference is high. If most people are doing the same thing, then the little bit of the personality or character quirks that kind of come through stand out in greater highlight, was his point of view. I can see you much better. And I saw that too when I was at Zen Center, because we spent a lot of time bowing to each other. And we had this form, like for meals, I'd be sitting like this in the meditation hall, and the servers would come and feed me. And they'd be a whole bunch over the years, there'd be lots of people would come and have it. We all take turns being servers, so everyone came through. And part of the idea of serving was you had to bow. And so all these servers would bow. When I was a server, I'd bow to all the people receiving the food. And everybody had to bow and put their hands together, flat together, and bend over like that. But their personalities came through in their bows. Some people bowed really low, and some people kind of just barely bowed, and some people felt the hesitancy of some people and the enthusiasm of some people. You can see in the forms, their personality and character came through. So the forms weren't meant in Zen to limit who you were, but rather to clarify who you were. Again, to help you find, really accept and clarify. Is that a question? Or are you just clear, you're just expressing your character? And so Jack Kornfield, who has spent a lot of his years as a teacher, talking to other teachers and visiting a lot of teachers and spending a lot of time with a lot of people who have practiced for a long time, mature practitioners, interested in the commonalities and the trends, or, you know, what is it that makes an enlightened person enlightened. And he's been a student of this whole spiritual tradition, as some of you know from his books. And he's come to the conclusion, after all his years of study, that the more spiritually mature a person becomes, the more eccentric they become. So, you know, if you expect you're supposed to be more self-effacing and kind of, you know, make a fuss and, you know, disappear kind of, maybe it's not the case, unless it's your character to be self-effacing. Because I've met people like that, and I've heard stories, again, same kind of stories in Thailand. People make the same kind of comments that if you go visit the different people in Thailand, in the Buddhist circles, monasteries, who are recognized as having some high attainment, maybe they're fully enlightened, they're arhats, and they're like, how different they are from each other. And one person, like Ajahn Mahabua, was a street fighter, kind of a boxer before he became a monk, and you go see him, he's ready, kind of, he's ready. And then there's this other guy, you know, who's also similar, fully enlightened in the tradition. And he's so sweet and quiet, and, you know, you hardly get a peep out of him if you go see him. You know, you ask him a question and he smiles. And, you know, you feel so nice, and, you know, you feel so accepted. And then you go to Mahabhuva. It's like, again, I remember Jack Kornfield's story of studying with his teacher. I think it was Ajahn Chah's story. And he had a little hut to live in near his own teacher. And so he could watch him. He watched him through the window and studied him a little bit and watched him in kind of more his private time. And I think he smoked cigarettes and he chewed beetle seed and was spitting it out and into his spittoon. And he was, you know, maybe farting and different things like that. I don't know. And so Jack went to him and said at some point, you know, you're not, how could you be well realized? How could you be a mature monk? You know, you're just, you know, you fart. Oh, wait. Jack doesn't tell a story that way, but. And so Ajahn Chah says, well, it's a good thing for you that I'm not your image of a Buddha or a fully enlightened person. Because then, I don't remember the story exactly. Do you remember it, Ernie? Is that more exact?
It's one of the Burmese teachers.
Oh, Burmese teacher. Oh, it wasn't Ajahn Chah.
I don't think so. No.
But you remember how the quote more exact?
Something about how it's good that you don't see me as a Buddha because then you try to be like me, or words to that effect.
Yeah. So, you all hear that? Oh, so the teacher, apparently it was a Burmese teacher, not Ajahn Chah, said, oh, it's a good thing I'm not like a Buddha, because then you try to be like me. Mm-hmm. And the point isn't to be like the teacher, but the point is to be yourself. But what does it mean to be yourself? That's an interesting question, right? Because many of us, you know, have certain degrees of neurosis. And so we become more happier neurotics through practice. I wouldn't knock that. That's pretty good. But to a certain degree, you know, what is our personality? What is our character? To what degree is our personality, for example, founded on things which we acquire as we grow up? I mean, a certain amount of fear, for example, in life, people go through traumas in their life, and that fear gets deeply embedded in their psyche and becomes a foundation upon which they see the world, by which they act and respond and speak. It is not inherent in the personality, perhaps, as much as something traumatic happened to them in their life. And so it's going to be woven into the personality, but it's not actually their innate personality. And as a person deals with their fear, or deals with their greed, their holding, their resistance to life, their hate, some of that will fall away from practice. And it's because of that that certain parts of our personality, that which is more innate, begins to stand out more clearly. Certainly the resistance to it, the inhibition to it, the feeling that it's not acceptable, the way in which we kind of take a social persona and put on top of it to be kind of nice to everyone, maybe kind of falls away to some degree. The fear-based aspects of personality that fall away. And so there is some falling away, some change that happens through practice. But that change is hopefully making you become more who you are rather than fitting into some kind of idea of who you are. So who are you? You know, who are you in your innateness? Who are you? You know, if everything went perfect from the day you were born, whatever perfection is, it can't happen that way. It's one of the reassurances I give myself as a parent now, is that I do my absolute best that I can to know how to parent well. But I am somewhat reassured in a little bit depressed way that I can't do it right. I'm not going to do it right. And what I can hopefully do is do it well enough so that child has the resources as an adult to sort it out. So I'm, you know, trying my best, and I have the ideal. I kind of operate the ideal that I can do it well, you know, perfectly. But I'm not living under this burden that I can. So I'm trying to live up to that, but then I'm not suffering because of that. It's quite something to watch children when they're born, as some of you have been around new children, to see, you know, how there seems to be this personality. A lot of it just comes with, they come born with this personality. It can be so different from each other. And you know, when my son was a little teeny little baby, we would have a lot of friends who had little babies, and to see how different these personalities were, you know, at 1 month, it was just quite remarkable. So who are you? And what are you holding back? What are you resisting? What are you not willing to show the world because somehow you feel it's unacceptable? But it's really who you are. And as long as you hold it back, you're going to suffer. It's going to be a burden and hold yourself in. And what is extra? What are you adding on there that is extra, is not who you are, but or is, you know, who you are, but could be resolved and dealt with, could be understood and seen clearly, so it doesn't become an inhibition or restriction to that which maybe is more innate or deeper within you. So kind of along this theme, I want to read this from the Gradual Sayings collection of Buddhist discourses. It's not very interesting, except if you're following what I'm saying and you're on the edge of your seat now. And what it is the Buddha goes through a list of all of his disciples, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, and names them, different ones, and say, this one is the one who's foremost in this way. This is the one that's foremost in this way. So I wanted to just read some of it to you. So he says, foremost among those disciples who are monks of long standing. I think what this means is, long standing means who's been the monk the longest, is Anya Kunyana. And he was one of the people, one of the five ascetics that the Buddha first taught to when he first went and started teaching. Chief among those of great wisdom is Sariputta. Chief among those of supernormal powers is great Moggallana. Chief among those who uphold the discipline is Kassapa the Great. Chief among those who are clairvoyant is Anuruddha. Chief among those who are of high caste is Badiya. Chief among those who are of sweet voice is Badiya the Dwarf. Chief among those who are lion roarers is Bharadvaja, the scrap hunter. Lion roarers is someone who, the footnotes explains it as, someone who is ready to make a claim. Any drop of a hat, ready to make any claim at all. I mean, truth. This guy is understood to be enlightened, so it's a truth claim. But you know, ready to kind of say it as it is. Chief among those who are expounders, chief among Dharma teachers who are monks is Punya. Chief among those who are expounders in full of brief sayings is Great Kachana. Chief among those who are skilled in creating, chief among those who in mental cultivation is Kula. Chief among those who are skilled in the cultivation of consciousness is Pantaka. Chief among those who live in peace is Subhuti. It goes on and on. I'll just kind of read just a few of them. Chief among those of meditative power is Rivata. Chief among those who are forest dwellers is another Rivata. Chief among those who strive energetically is Sona. Chief of those who have clear utterances is Sona, another Sona. Chief among those who have faith is Vakali. Chief among those who are eager to train is Rahula, who was his son. Chief among those who became monks out of faith is Ratapala. Chief among those who have ready wit is Vangisa. Chief among those who are altogether charming is Upasena. Chief among those who are dear and delightful to the gods is Pilinda. Chief among those who are brilliant speakers is Kassapa. Chief among those who have retentive memory, chief of those among those who have good behavior, who are resolute, who have large followings, who are good at reconciling families, who are of good health, who are able to recall past lives, who know the disciplinary rules by heart. This was translated a long time ago in Victorian times in England. Not quite, actually. It was first published in 1932 in England. Because the next one says, chief among those who are admonishers of the nuns is nun. I hope it says something different in Pali. Oh, but there's someone else who is chief among those who are admonishers of the monks. Chief among those who are good at contemplating the heart is Sagata. Chief of those who are impromptu speakers. And then there's the nuns of great wisdom, of supernormal power, who are proficient in the rules of discipline, who are Dharma teachers, who have great meditation powers, who strive energetically, who are clairvoyant, who remember past lives, who attain great supernormal powers, who have been liberated out of faith. And then all the lay men, chief among those who are good or alms givers and make donations, among those who are among the Dharma teachers who are lay people. There were lay Dharma teachers back in the time of the Buddha. Is Chitta. Those who have unwavering loyalty. Those who converse intimately. I don't know, I've never thought of that. But anyway, chief among those who converse intimately. And then the lay women of wide knowledge who live in with loving kindness, who have meditative power, who nurse the sick, who converse intimately. So what I like about this is two things. One is that there's a long list of people And they each specialize in something else. Because of their personality, their characters, their abilities, they stand out from each other. They're different from each other. And some people excel at one thing, some at someone else. And there's no feeling when the Buddha says this that one is better than the other or he's judging them negatively. But this is each of these people is enlightened in some way or other. And each of these people then has different personalities, different ways in which their karma or their genes or whatever work themselves out. And they become different from everybody else. They stand out in some way. How is it for you? Are you willing to stand out in some way? Are you willing to, do you have some sense of what is your, if at all, your destiny or your karma or what the essence of you, who you are, or your passion or your interest or what you're good at? Do you feel you feel free enough to act on what you most love and let that become clarified and become who you are? The other reason I like this list is that a number of these things were not just simply things people were innately born to, but rather are potentials they grew into. And accepting who we are would hopefully include accepting what our potential is. And in accepting our potential, not to then berate ourselves for not living up to it or not measuring ourselves against some standard which is not realistic. But each of us has a potential in some way or other to develop ourselves, to cultivate ourselves. And do you have the courage or do you have the enthusiasm, the interest to follow through on that potential? I think all of you have come here, which is a meditation group. And meditation, cultivating our ability to meditate, cultivating our ability to be mindful, to be alert, to be concentrated, to be calm, is a potential you all have. So is this a potential that you want to develop and cultivate? Is this a potential you want to enhance, develop so it becomes a source of refuge, a source of strength, a source of aid, help in your life? Are there potentials that you can accept as being, oh yes, I have this potential, and then and follow through in developing it? Are there potentials that you specialize in? And traditionally, in ancient India and Theravadan Buddhism, people weren't just taught mindfulness as the one and only practice. The idea of one practice fits everyone doesn't really appear in the early Buddhist tradition. Later in Buddhism, it does appear in different areas. You find, maybe for different historical, sociological reasons, you find at different times Buddhists emphasizing one kind of one shoe fits all. One of the times was Kamakura period in Japan, the time when Soto Zen evolved in Dogen. There was a whole slew of different teachers who were taking out of the whole wide medicine chest of Buddhism one medicine and saying, this is the medicine. Dogen was just sitting, Shikantaza. Another person did chanting Amida Buddha's name. We're different. One practice fits all. You find in Tibetan Buddhism also sometimes, occasionally, the idea of one practice fits all. And you find in American Vipassana, kind of by default, sometimes you get that sense also. But in recognizing what is the potential we have and seeing how that potential, our own particular unique potential, can be a support for developing our meditation or our inner spiritual life, I think is a valuable reflection. For those people who have a tremendous capacity for compassion, to develop that compassion, and that developed compassion becomes a strength that supports a spiritual life. For those people who have the ability to get concentrated, then to cultivate that concentration as support for their spiritual life. And for those people who don't have an ability to develop concentration very well, and some people don't, there's nothing wrong with that, it's not a personal flaw, maybe there's other things you can develop that can be as supportive. Loving kindness. Maybe you have the ability to develop kindness. Maybe you have the ability to develop energy, energetic endeavoring. One of my strengths as a practitioner, I feel, has been my strong resolve. I don't think of myself as someone who has a good capacity for concentration. And sometimes when I pay attention to myself, I don't think I have good capacity for mindfulness even though I'm a mindfulness teacher. It's kind of embarrassing, But it's probably true for most of you. But certainly it's gotten stronger over the years, more and more. But what I do have a strength for is strength of resolve. And so when I sit down to meditate or go on retreat or other areas of my spiritual life, I can be very resolved. And that resolve has gotten really much developed through practice because I'm acting on it. And as you act on it, it becomes stronger. And for me, that resolve has then fed in to my ability to be mindful, my ability to be concentrated. And my ability to get very deeply concentrated, which I've done sometimes, is really on the, in the tail, in a sense, of my tremendous resolve. For other people, it might be in the tail of tremendous ability to let go. Some people have great ability to let go, really easy. And that's what they develop. That's their capacity they develop. Some people have great intellectual capacity. And so they can have very clear reasoning. And it can be very, very helpful in spiritual life to be able to reason very, very clearly. And it can, it's a kind of a liberation that can come from that. And so Shariputra was one of those people who had that ability. Other people have, you get the principle now, what I'm trying to say. Is there some potential you have? And in recognizing some potential you have, it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, some potential you have to excel at, greater than everybody else. But given the combination of who you are, all the different qualities of who you are, is there something that, you know, is, you know, that you value more or seems more natural to you that you can want to follow through on as a way of giving support to your spiritual life? So that's all I had to say. And for better or worse, Dharma talks are just an expression of whoever's giving the talk. So I hope you got the point I was trying to make. Radical self-acceptance of who you are. Don't try to become someone else. Try to become yourself. But in doing that, try to do the practice of mindfulness, self-introspection, to try to separate out the debris, the chaff from the seed, from the wheat, that which is extra, not needed, that which is fear-based, or that which comes from social conditioning. And if part of who you are is some potential of what's possible, don't be afraid of your potential. Don't be burdened by your potential in any kind of way, but don't be afraid of it. It's one of the great and beautiful things in life is to be engaged in following through on one's potential. And for me personally, and this has been one of my, I think, saving attitudes around many things that I do, I actually enjoy more doing things than succeeding or getting them done. And so it doesn't matter that much. It does matter some, but it doesn't matter that much whether I succeed so well or, you know, I just love just being engaged. And so sometimes when I do succeed successfully in something, I'm ready to forget it right away because I'm just ready, because the memory of having done it, that doesn't do me any good. You know, I'm ready to do the next thing. And so if I fail sometimes at something, the memory of having failed, you know, I mean, I try to learn from my failures for sure, but the engagement. So don't be afraid of your potential. And maybe for you also, the engagement in fulfilling your potential can be a source of joy and pleasure in and of itself. There's 5 minutes left for some of you to express yourself, if you dare, or ask a question. Yes?
It's interesting. The Greek words perfection means to reach one's potential, not to resemble some platonic form, so that a whole forest of trees, each different, each of them would be considered in the original meaning perfect, even though they look very different.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Could you hear that in the back?
I was struck by what this is a list of, the qualities that he chose to note. It seems like they're qualities of inner nature and ones which are admired, which are could be considered virtues. He's not talking about people who have an angry nature or have any other sort of nature which would be according to Buddhism, not thought to develop, right? And I just noticed that. It's interesting. But then I noticed also they don't include traits which come about as a result of training. Like if somebody developed an ability to write poetry, he didn't mention that. Or an ability to perform or write music or do other skills. And I wondered about those, particularly whether those were, it was sort of accidental that they weren't mentioned? I don't think so.
So Dick is asking, why is it that all the qualities mentioned seem to be virtues and not, you know, foremost among those who are angry? Why are some other good qualities or good potentials not listed, like the ability to you know, compose poetry and stuff like that? They're good questions. I suspect that the list is referring to all things that are supportive for the Buddhist spiritual life. And so there is one here, the spontaneous utterances, which I think is a Victorian way of translating a Pali word, which actually means being able to compose verse, on Dharma verses spontaneously, which they used to do back then. So I think maybe, because the Buddha is interested in people's spiritual development, he's highlighting those people who have some quality that is directly connected to the spiritual life, the Buddhist spiritual life. So that's why he's listing them. And there could be maybe a wider list of things, but the but also he only had a limited number of disciples around him. So, you know, if we were around him, he would probably say different things, right?
But all those things would clearly be advantageous to developing spiritual life in a sangha, even. Of course, it's nice to have people that are good listeners and sympathetic and all that sort of thing. Yes, thank you.
But what you said, you know, I think it points to an interesting point. And that is that the Buddha doesn't list that person's foremost the one in, you know, who's angry or something like that. Is that, remember, you all might have been monkeys or equivalent in past life. So there might be things that pass through you. There might be, like you might have been a street fighter or something, and so there's kind of assertiveness, aggressiveness or something that's kind of there, kind of bubbling up this energy. Or maybe you were kind of nice little, you know, pigeon in past life, you know. Or I don't know what. But just because the Buddha lists all these virtues doesn't mean that some quality, you know, be very careful you don't limit some innate quality that's pouring through you, because it doesn't fit some idea of it's not, you know, it's non-virtuous, or some idea that this is not acceptable. So meditation is one of the really best places to explore all this, I feel. There might be other places that are maybe as good or better, I don't know, but meditation is a very powerful place to explore just being yourself. Learning to accept yourself in a radical way, developing your potential, and getting out of your own way, and not having any inhibitions on what wants to be expressed as it goes through you. And if you really want to find out who you are in a deep way, I think it's best in your meditation you put no judgments and no inhibitions on whatever happens to move through you. If you call it virtuous or if you call it unvirtuous, don't bother with those kinds of judgments. If you get angry, just be angry. Let it come through you. And meditation is a safe place to be that way. And get out of its way. Just learn how to get out of the way of what's there. And getting out of the way means, of course, you're not fueling it, not acting on it. But in that process, hopefully learn how to clarify more and more what's at the essence of who you are. Good luck.
Curious about something. Was there nobody that excelled in two things, or was he trying to be kind?
Was there no one who excelled in two things? Subhuti, I didn't read this, but Subhuti, who was the foremost among those in peace, he's listed twice. And I think it's the same Subhuti, but because sometimes he has the same name, but they have a little nickname in the back or last name, so it's two different people. But it seems that, I don't know, maybe he was being kind, or maybe, I don't know what. Okay. Oh, so last one, and then we'll stop. Please, Mark.
Yeah, I was just wondering the context of the Buddha making a list and pointing out individuals. Was this like the award ceremony?
The foremost among those who teach mindfulness-based stress reduction is Mark Abramson. It doesn't say anything. There's no context. It just begins with a list. So, I don't know what to say. Why he did this? He probably had some idea that it would be helpful. And the people who listed, because they were enlightened, they didn't need to be told.
Well, it's like saying one person doesn't have to have all these qualities to be enlightened, but,
Exactly. So what it's saying is one person doesn't have to have all these qualities to be enlightened. And so enlightenment doesn't have to do with qualities at all. Isn't that nice? So you don't have to measure your enlightenment by the qualities you have or don't have.
Aren't there some that you better not have?
Greed, hate.
Greed, for instance, other negatives like that.
That's the way it says. Greed, hate, and delusion are uprooted. Just like if you cut down a banana, the trunk of a banana tree or palm tree, it will not grow again. So if you cut off the roots of greed, hate, and delusion, they will not sprout again. But you might still, be a monkey. Yes?
I'm wondering if you have any tips on how to distinguish between the meditation or even in life the authentic self, and you said there's these kind of rigidified, trauma-based, etc., stuff that happened in life.
Yeah.
How does one distinguish between what's the authentic identity and something from history? Or, you know what I'm saying?
I do understand. It's a very good question. The question is, how do you distinguish between that which is authentic and who we are, and that which has been kind of imposed upon us by social conditioning or trauma or different things? And I don't have a good answer for you, I don't think. But what comes to mind is one of the very helpful guideposts for, I think, this kind of investigation or any investigation in Buddhism is, are you suffering? So if there's any suffering connected to what's coming through you, then you should stop and look at that suffering. The suffering might be secondary, where it's judgments about it rather than it itself. But once you clarify that secondary suffering, then you can really be with the primary quality. Then in that primary quality, is there suffering there or not? And then you revisit it over the years, because as your mindfulness gets stronger, you might notice aspects of suffering there. They were very so subtle you didn't notice them at first, but you use suffering as your guideline. If you're not suffering,
so if it's suffering, it's the authentic me.
No, I wouldn't say that. So the question is, if it's suffering, is it the authentic me? I don't think that's the case. I think that for very mature Dharma practitioners, I believe, this is kind of an interpretation, the Buddha emphasized that you should not use any idea of self in understanding your experience. Because any idea of self, to understand your experience in relationship to the self, gets in the way. It's actually a very subtle kind of suffering in making that reference. So, is this my authentic self is extra. That's not needed to make that statement. But so you don't want to say, suffering is authentic self. That I think Buddhists would never say that. But suffering can be your guide to help you find the authentic expression that moves through you. Because you study your suffering and you clarify it, you resolve it, you find your freedom there. And once you find your freedom resolved or clarified or brought the suffering to an end, then what shines forth, perhaps, is much more authentic.
But the First Noble Truth, there is always suffering.
I don't know if it doesn't say there is always suffering. There's always suffering in the world. It doesn't mean you have to always suffer. And that's what Buddhist practice is helping you to come to, so you don't suffer. So many thanks. May all of you be very happy in being yourself.